KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
While we do not yet know what caused the Ethan wildfire, we are looking at every possibility in SCE's investigation.
NPR's investigations team found evidence suggesting an electricity company slowed down firefighting efforts in Los Angeles last month.
It's Monday, February 17th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In Syria, how much freedom of expression has expanded under the new government?
We're trying to see where is the limit that we can speak. But for right now, we're speaking whatever we want.
Also, New York City's mayor has agreed to help President Trump crack down on immigration.
The fear infects everything. People in school, people coming to church, people are worried about being out in public.
How could this reshape a city that has long been friendly to immigrants?
And it's been one really hot summer in Rio de Janeiro.
Those stories and many more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Ukraine will be watching developments in Saudi Arabia tomorrow when top diplomats from the U.S. and Russia are expected to meet for the first time since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is set to arrive in Saudi Arabia on Wednesday, but, he said, only for an official visit with Saudi officials. Zelensky said there cannot be negotiations without Ukraine. Oleksandr Kraev, a political scientist in Kyiv, says Zelensky expects President Trump to make Ukraine an equal partner in talks to end the war.
In any other case, the negotiation will be a futile effort, and Trump will be presented as a bad negotiator, weak politician, and a bad diplomat, basically.
Trump's special envoy for Ukraine and Russia is expected to visit Ukraine later this week. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Trump administration says it's begun firing several hundred Federal Aviation Administration workers, something that is upending staff during a busy air travel weekend with the President's Day holiday, and just weeks after a fatal mid-air collision in Washington, D.C., involving an American Airlines plane and a military helicopter that claimed the lives of 67 people. Some FAA probationary employees were reportedly notified Friday they were being let go, including reportedly workers hired for FAA radar, landing, and navigational maintenance. Across the U.S. on this President's Day holiday, protests were staged denouncing President Trump and billionaire advisor Elon Musk, the leader of the administration's government efficiency team. Brian Bull of member station KLCC reports from one of the protests in Eugene, Oregon.
Hundreds of people flooded an intersection outside the Wayne Morse Federal Courthouse, holding signs that accused Trump and Musk of violating the law and turning control of the country over to billionaires. In the rain, Rajin Manis held an umbrella with anti-Trump and anti-Musk messages.
The Republicans, led by Donald Trump, have staged a coup on our government. Elon Musk is at the helm. All the other billionaires are right next to them.
Trump has defended his executive orders and sweeping cuts of the federal workforce. In a social media post over the weekend, Trump wrote, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
As the cryptocurrency industry seeks to reinforce its newfound influence with the Trump administration, a couple of proposals from crypto-friendly lawmakers are being floated. One would set regulations and reserve requirements for issuers of what are known as stable coins, a cryptocurrency that is basically pegged to the dollar. Another would set clear rules on how digital assets should be regulated. U.S. financial markets are closed today for the President's Day holiday. You're listening to NPR. Southwest Airlines is announcing today it's cutting about 15% of corporate jobs at the carrier, or roughly 1,750 jobs, as the airline looks to cut costs and streamline operations. It marks the first mass layoff in the Dallas-based airline's 53-year history and includes nearly a dozen senior management positions. Layoffs come as Southwest has been in a battle with Elliott Investment Management, an activist investor firm. Southwest estimates cuts will save more than $200 million this year and $300 million next year. This spring, movie audiences may think they are seeing double or even more than double. NPR's Bob Mondello explains.
In a new mafia epic, Robert De Niro plays real-life mob boss Vito Genovese.
Where do I start?
And also plays rival mob boss Frank Costello.
You're going down a very dangerous road. And we ain't been down dangerous roads before.
I tell you, but you're not where I am.
De Niro meets De Niro in The Alto Knights. Michael B. Jordan has a similar double assignment in the thriller Sinners.
You twins?
Nah, we cousins.
Nope, twin brothers named Smoke and Stack. And if double casting seems tricky, it's child's play next to what Robert Pattinson signed on for in the cloning movie Mickey 17.
Every time I died, they just printed me out again.
There are so many of him that one day he meets himself.
Multiples.
Multiples of movie multiples, coming soon to the multiplex. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
While U.S. stock markets are closed today, oil was trading globally up 65 cents a barrel to end the session at $71.39 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage Service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Investigators are analyzing video suggesting that problems on high power lines owned by Southern California Edison caused last month's Eaton fire in Los Angeles. But the start of the fire wasn't the only issue. NPR's investigations team reviewed first responder radio transmissions and found evidence that the electric utility company also played a role in slowing down firefighting efforts. Here's NPR's Kiara Eisner.
When high winds and dry conditions whip up a wildfire, power lines can cause problems by sparking or falling down. That's dangerous for first responders on the ground, and it can start new fires.
Yeah, I'd like to see if we can get Edison out and have them assess, see what we can do about cutting power to everything north of Sierra Madre from Baldwin Avenue all the way to the west.
6 hours after the Eaton fire first started on January 7th, firefighters needed help, but the power company couldn't respond quickly.
Hey, Delta Branch 3, hey, I just met with Edison's reps. They're not going to be able to guarantee shutdown in here. They're short on manpower, so we're just going to have to treat everything as live and be heads up.
By nighttime on January 8th, firefighters make another shutoff request.
Everything north of Woodbury is what we're requesting to be shut off. I'll follow up with you once I get a hold of Tocal Edison.
A firefighter incident report notes that at around 10 p.m., quote, the combination of low humidity, dry fuels, and shifting winds has heightened the potential for spot fires and rapid expansion. But just after 10 p.m., a firefighter says again, Edison can't do what firefighters asked right away.
Zulu from IC, from our SoCal Edison contact. These wires are to be considered energized, even the wires that have portions that are down. They currently do not have a plan to mitigate this issue tonight. They're looking at handling this tomorrow morning.
NPR analyzed almost 100 hours of radio traffic exchanged between firefighters responding to the Eaton fire. Reporters downloaded the audio from Broadcastify.com, a live audio streaming platform. We shared some of that audio with Michael Wara, an attorney and research scholar at Stanford, and he was shocked to hear Edison didn't turn the power off quickly.
Edison has a responsibility to be available to emergency responders in these contexts, and their emergency operations center was active. And so it's surprising that they would say that they cannot assist emergency responders during a situation like that.
After Edison declined NPR's request for an interview, a representative told reporters the company was, quote, adequately staffed for the event. But the communications NPR obtained indicate the company's staff added to confusion about why power was on in the area 2 days later. At around 2:20 p.m. on January 10th, a firefighter in Altadena called in with an urgent message.
Yeah, I got an emergent situation. Right now it looks like there is re-energizing power lines in the Zulu area, which is causing a lot of lines that are down to start arcing, and we're getting new starts over there.
Sheila Kellier is a fire captain with the L.A. County Fire Department. Kellier explained how dangerous arcing is in extremely dry and windy conditions.
If those sparks start really going, because they can be pretty dramatic, and as they spark and arc, if the wind's blowing that spark and hits palm fronds that are all dried out, that'll start a fire quick, especially when the winds are blowing. That's all it takes.
The firefighter on the ground tries to figure out what's going on.
Can you confirm with Edison if they are charging lines? And if they are, we'll need to stop for a bit.
The fire department's liaison to the energy company responds.
I spoke to Edison this morning, and they said they are not re-energizing anything for at least until the beginning of next week, depending upon the winds.
Okay. Can you make a secondary call and explain the situation that we're getting arcing and new starts? We probably need some personnel to come out and validate all this.
When power is off, some people use generators to run their homes, and those generators can energize lines. In that secondary call, that's what Edison tells firefighters is happening.
Attorney Liaison, I just got off the phone with Edison. They have confirmed they are not re-energizing anything, and he has confirmed that people are using generators to repower themselves.
Within half an hour, the radio communications show a fire had started near a house right between the wildfire perimeter and the area where firefighters said the power was on and causing problems.
Reported wires down on house with tree fire.
Power lines were involved in that fire. And just 1 minute later, firefighters confirmed it was Edison that was responsible for powering those lines, not generators.
Affirmative. And just confirmed with Edison units on the ground, these lines are live. They have recharged the lines.
Copy. They being the residents with generators, correct?
Negative. SoCal Edison, representative on the ground, trouble bin, have charged the lines. They're circuit testing.
Again, the firefighter asks Edison to shut it down.
Liaison, you copy. Make a call to have them cease that operation.
In a video released on February 6th, Edison's CEO, Pedro Pizarro, said the company is investigating the cause of the fire and looking into evidence.
While we do not yet know what caused the Ethan wildfire, we are looking at every possibility in SCE's investigation, including the possibility that the utility's equipment was involved.
Multiple lawsuits have been filed against Edison that claim the utility's equipment was responsible for the fire's start. Michael Wara, the Stanford lawyer, said the audio communications NPR unearthed indicate there was also a breakdown in the utility company's protocols around what to do after fires first start.
Edison is accountable for making sure that there aren't problems before they turn the power back on. If you've got down lines and you re-energize the system, you're going to start new fires, which is what the firefighters are describing.
The Eaton fire burned more than 14,000 acres and wasn't completely contained for more than 3 weeks. 17 people died. Property losses are estimated in the tens of billions of dollars. Kiara Eisner, NPR News.
A rebel coalition overthrew a repressive regime in Syria last December. And now, after decades of surveillance and control, Syrians are cautiously testing the newly expanded boundaries for free expression. But as NPR's Emily Fang reports, fresh constraints are emerging.
The night is young and the crowd is raucous here in this stand-up comedy bar in Damascus's old city. Comedian Omar Jayav gets on stage and he starts ripping one-liners. He is unsparing, going after the former regime run by the Assad family, but also the rebel fighting group that is now a major party in Syria's new interim government. And the audience loves it. I speak to Jayab backstage. He says the room for free expression has gotten so much better after the regime fell.
Because now we can do more political jokes that we couldn't use to do. Now we can do it freely.
I ask him if he senses there are any limits to what he can say.
We're trying to see where is the limit that we can speak. But for right now, we're speaking whatever we want.
For now. And he might discover those limits soon. There are signs already that HTS, as head of Syria's interim government, wants control over information. And as this news producer with a prominent broadcaster tells us, outlets that operated under the old regime must now first post the drafts of all news stories in an online chat to be cleared by a government official. A second manager at another major outlet confirmed this. Like all the journalists who NPR spoke to for this piece, they asked that we not use their names for fear of reprisals from the HTS government. She says HTS officials have also taken over her outlet's social media channels to post their content. Reading horoscopes aloud on radio has long been popular programming, but two outlets told NPR that is now banned for running counter to Islamist tenets. A second Syrian journalist explains a major broadcaster has also been banned from playing most music and television series because that too is viewed disapprovingly by some Islamist hardliners. And when her outlet tried to interview the new government's officials, they said they would only speak to male anchors, not female journalists. Two separate journalists also say the new HTS government has been only granting access to their official events to their affiliated media outlets. At another major news organization, the government has replaced the director with their own official and put nearly 20% of the current staff on paid leave. The broadcast producer says the new government of Syria is pushing aside journalists. It wrongly assumes we're loyal to the former regime, which she denies. She says, in fact, they were victims too, forced to follow the old regime's diktats. Many of them are now hoping this current government does not fall back into those old habits. Emily Fang, NPR News, Damascus.
It's icy cold and snowy in parts of the U.S. today, but not in Brazil. Rio de Janeiro hit 107 degrees today, prompting safety warnings. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Okay, it is summertime here in Brazil, but this is spectacularly hot. Not everybody's complaining, though. Just ask a few tourists from up north.
It's really hot. It's really, really hot.
Justina Jack from Montreal is on vacation.
Back home, there's like 30 centimeters of snow right now, so not hating the heat at all.
At noon today, Rio hit that record 107.6. Rio's mayor warned residents to take it easy, but it is carnival season, so he didn't discourage partying, just emphasized hydrating.
Corona, Brahma, Heineken, Coca, Agua.
Beer vendor Graziano da Silva is helping with that on Copacabana Beach.
Agua.
Water is the top seller today. It's too hot, he says. Beach umbrellas are a must, coolers too, or like some beachgoers, just have huge bags of ice around them. Paulo Roberto Morao is hardcore, no umbrella and no beer.
Não faça isso que eu faço não, que vai...
The 62-year-old nurse pretty much says, do as I say, not as I do, to avoid skin cancer.
With plenty of ice-cold water, a wide-brim hat, and lots of sunblock, Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Copacabana Beach, Rio.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Embattled New York City Mayor Eric Adams has agreed to collaborate with the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Now, that is a significant shift for a city that has historically welcomed immigrants from around the globe, been shaped by those newcomers, and for years had a sanctuary policy. NPR's Jasmine Gardst went out to ask New Yorkers, is this still a city that welcomes immigrants?
On a cold morning in Upper Manhattan, in the back of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, Episcopalian Bishop Matthew Hyde reflects on how abruptly things have changed in the last few months.
The fear infects everything. People in school, people coming to church, people are worried about being out in public, doing even basic things like going to the supermarket.
But he also says his parishioners are taking action more than ever. He tells me about volunteers who buy groceries for immigrant families who are scared of going out and being caught in an immigration raid. Ordinary people have been stepping up, he says.
Because the people who inhabit official positions aren't stepping up.
For months, New York Mayor Eric Adams has been battling corruption charges. During that time, he's warmed up to the Trump administration. Last week, the Department of Justice demanded the charges against Adams be dropped, emphasizing that the charges were blocking the mayor's ability to support the administration's immigration crackdown. For some New Yorkers, this has been welcome news. Here's Peter Junta.
He's willing to work with the administration on delivering on these policies that arguably all Americans gave President Trump a mandate to enact.
Junta is the chairman of the New York State Young Republicans. We're meeting for Italian sandwiches at a popular spot on Staten Island. The city has taken in over 200,000 migrants in the last 3 years. Junta says it's about time it starts cracking down. I point out that we're sitting here eating Staten Island classics, brajout and gabagool sandwiches. I ask him, isn't New York's identity shaped by immigrants?
I would disagree with that. I think New York's core identity is the New Yorker, not some person that came over from Guatemala or somewhere else. The immigrants that came over in the early 1900s and in the late 1800s, like my great-grandparents, Italian, obviously, right? Very different set of values than I would argue some of the migrants that have come over today have.
Other people NPR interviewed expressed similar views. Even recent immigrants, some of whom feel today's newcomer is different from their own family members when they arrived in the U.S.
Sí, soy dominicano. Estoy entre esta sorpresa de los grupos de los latinos que hemos apoyado a Trump.
Carlos Collado owns a supermarket in the Bronx. He's originally from the Dominican Republic. He's been in the U.S. for 3 decades. He's a citizen and a lifelong Democrat, but he voted for Trump because he was alarmed at all the migrants coming into the city. I felt it would be better for small business owners, he said, more law and order. But he's also wary about the mayor warming up to the Trump administration. Yes, he wants more immigration control, but I don't want families separated, he says. People who are just here working hard, who haven't committed crimes. In recent days, Mayor Adams has said he wants to crack down on, quote, violent migrant gangs who he claims are terrorizing the city. There's been no evidence that migrant gangs are rampaging New York. In fact, violent crime is down, a fact the mayor often boasts about. But ultimately, that distinction between criminal and non-criminal means little to immigrants without legal status. The fear of deportation is widespread. By nightfall, we head over to Queens. Roosevelt Avenue, located underneath the 7 train, is known for its bustling immigrant street vendors. I ask a vendor who sells Colombian buñuelos, warm dough pastries, if he's ever seen people so afraid.
No, realmente no.
He asked that we refer to him by his first initial only, T, because in his 20 plus years living in New York, he's never been so afraid of immigration enforcement. Out here eating buñuelos with us is Karina Kaufman Gutierrez. She's with the Street Vendors Project, a group that advocates for vendors, almost all of whom are immigrants. Is New York City still a place for immigrants? She says we've been asking the wrong question. Immigrants are New York.
The people who pay taxes in his city, those are the people who run New York and are being served up on a silver platter for President Trump.
Immigration, she says, is as New York as a thin crust slice of pizza or a warm buñuelo on a cold winter night in Queens. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from David Jefferson. In 2022, David's wife Jill was diagnosed with cancer. Jill didn't have many close friends, but one of her former coworkers, a woman named Nicole Kyle, started coming by to try and cheer her up. Soon, Nicole became a consistent comfort to the couple. So in 2024, it did not surprise David when Nicole offered to help him get Jill home after a hospital stay. What did surprise him was the lengths she went to once they got Jill home. David recorded his story in a park where he and Jill hoped to one day hike together. So you'll hear some wind in the background.
Nicole and I got Jill home. It was during a winter snowstorm. The pipes had frozen in the house, but we got them thawed out. Nicole and I gave Jill a shower and put her to bed. Some hours later, Nicole showed up with a bag. Show me which room you want me to sleep in, and I'll stay until the end with Jill. Nicole, in a very unselfish way, took care of the laundry, food, house cleaning. She invited her friends to bring over food, along with some of the food my friends were bringing. Nicole would get up in the middle of the night with me and help roll Jill over and attend to her private needs, as only another woman could. Nicole was a steady presence. She never panicked. She always had a smile and willing to do whatever what was next. Nicole helped me see Jill to the end of her life, which was February 3rd, 2024. Nicole was an angel in the time of need, and I'll forever be in her debt. This situation called for a hero, and Nicole Kyle is my hero for life.
Listener David Jefferson. Jill and David were together for 36 years. Since her passing, David has dedicated his time to doing things that he and Jill hoped to do together. His most recent adventure was a trip to Las Cruces, New Mexico. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which reminds you of the power of one human voice. You turn on the radio some morning, or your device, and you're listening to Morning Edition, and you hear one person telling a story from the other side of the world or from a neighborhood near you. And that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
That's all things considered. From NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A program in Chicago is showing promising results in reducing gun violence among young people.
I got tired of seeing the community repeating the same cycle on and on and on. And here, I got to do what I got to do to better myself.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A judge appears unlikely to grant a request to immediately halt an effort by Elon Musk to access federal data and fire government employees. NPR's Stephen Fowler tells us about a hearing today that took up a lawsuit filed by several Democratic state attorneys general.
This lawsuit argues Elon Musk's influential role in the government is illegal and should be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. The best word to describe Judge Tanya Chutkan in this hour-long hearing, skeptical. Skeptical of the government's claims that Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency don't have that much power, and skeptical that the state suing have showed enough evidence to halt, for now, actions in seven federal agencies. Chutkan said she'll issue a ruling in the next 24 hours. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
A new report finds about 5 billion people, or 60% of the world's population, does not have access to high-quality medical oxygen. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel reports.
Medical oxygen is used for a whole host of reasons, from babies born prematurely to patients with heart failure, asthma, or pneumonia. The shortage of safe, high-quality, and affordable oxygen is most acute in low- and middle-income countries. The report, which is the first of its kind, found that the lack of medical oxygen is contributing to hundreds of thousands of preventable deaths each year, and it's reducing the quality of life for millions more. The report found that fixing the shortfall will cost almost $7 billion a year, but the authors say it's as cost-effective as childhood vaccinations. Plus, it helps with pandemic preparedness. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
Well, the stock market was closed today in honor of President's Day. Later this week, investors will be getting an update on the housing market. This is NPR News. It's icy, snowy, and cold in much of the U.S., but record hot in Brazil. Rio de Janeiro hit 107 degrees today, prompting city officials there to issue health warnings and open cooling centers. Here's NPR's Carrie Kahn.
Even at famous Copacabana Beach, it was hot.
Corona, Brahma, Heineken, Coca, Agua.
Beers are selling fast, but water is tops today, say vendors. Three more extremely hot days are expected. This is high summer carnival season that prompted Rio's mayor to raise the new heat warning to level 4 out of 5. Some schools closed and city workers are getting hydration breaks. More than 50 cooling centers have opened. A high-pressure system over the ocean is blocking any cold weather from coming on shore. There's no rain in the upcoming forecast. Southern Brazil, part of the country's vast farm belt, is experiencing record drought. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
The Vatican says Pope Francis will remain hospitalized and needs more treatment for a respiratory tract infection. Officials say the 88-year-old pontiff will require more targeted drug treatment for what doctors describe as a mix of bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites growing in his lungs. As a young adult, Pope Francis had part of one lung removed and has been prone to lung infections in recent years. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
Where is Congress?
Do your job!
Where is Congress?
Do your job!
That is the sound of thousands of protesters gathering in front of the Capitol today. They're speaking out against recent actions by the Trump administration and have protests planned in other cities as well. What do we know about who is organizing these protests and what is their ultimate goal? Well, for help answering those questions, we're joined now by NPR's Shondalise Duster. She was in the crowd today and has been following the story. Hi, Shondalise.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so what was the protest like today? Like, what did it feel like to be out there?
There were very large crowds surrounding the Capitol reflecting pool. People from Washington, D.C. and surrounding areas such as Maryland were there. People told me they are scared and outraged by what President Trump and Elon Musk are doing to federal agencies. A woman from Maryland told me her husband is a federal worker and they are making financial plans in case he is laid off as the Trump administration carries out these mass firings. A woman who came down to the protest from New Jersey told me she's frustrated by what she believes is inaction by lawmakers to protect federal agencies.
They need to realize this is different. Nothing is the same. And if you let this go, it's only going to get worse. And we see this every day. It gets worse every day. So if not now, it won't happen.
It's important to note the point of these protests is to be widespread. They were not just in Washington, D.C., but in other state capitals from California all the way to Massachusetts. Hundreds of people gathered in ice-cold Boston, in Georgia, and in Colorado.
And can you tell us more about the group that's been organizing these protests?
Yes. So 5051 stands for 50 Protests, 50 States, One Movement. It originated on Reddit in response to the Trump administration and its efforts to slash government spending. POTUS Black is a local organizer for 5051's D.C. chapter. And Black told organizers today that they were steps away from the U.S. Capitol for one purpose, to stand united and uphold the U.S. Constitution.
The events over the past month have been built to exhaust us, to break our wills. But we are the American people. We will not break.
The protests are being coordinated with several groups, including Political Revolution. That is a group founded by volunteers from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign.
Okay. And Shondalise, how do these protests compare to previous protest movements against the Trump administration, you think?
Well, on his first full day in office, Trump faced massive protests. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators turned out January 21st, 2017 in Washington, D.C., the day after Trump's first inauguration. That protest was called the Women's March. These protests haven't seen crowds in terms of numbers like the Women's March in 2017, but the geographic reach is strong. The first 5051 movement protest took place on February 5th, and organizers tell me thousands of people gathered across 88 cities. Organizers also tell me today's protest is not the last one and more are planned in the future.
That is NPR's Shondalise Duster. Thank you so much, Shondalise.
Thank you.
A high school program in Chicago is showing promising results, reducing arrests for violent crimes in some of the city neighborhoods most plagued by shootings. One key to its success is a concept borrowed from poker, where players keep emotions in check. NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson has more.
In the hallways of a high school in the Englewood neighborhood on Chicago's South Side, students are laughing, chatting, and goofing around between classes. But many will tell you the violence in their neighborhood weighs on them. Nearly 100 people were shot here last year.
It affected me as a young Black man because walking down the street with your friends, like, you gotta worry about, oh, watch that car, oh, watch that alley.
That was A.M., I'm referring to students by their initials to protect them from stigma they might face for speaking about their experiences. Another student, AW, says she used to feel mad all the time.
I was doing bad, I'm not gonna lie. I was like fighting and stuff a lot.
Hyper awareness, lashing out. Experts say these can be reactions to chronic stress. So last year, educators tapped these students for a six-month program called Choose to Change. It focuses on young people who are struggling. Some are affiliated with gangs, on juvenile probation, getting in trouble at school, or not showing up consistently. Students in the program get a mentor, and they attend weekly group therapy sessions, where clinicians use cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, to help change their thought patterns, especially around traumatic experiences.
What we try to do is to have them look at those instances in a different way, like consider yourself a survivor.
Program director Chris Sutton says hearing students articulate what's hard in their lives is real progress.
We're just trying to get them to key in on some of those wins that you don't give yourself credit for, because it's all a part of your story.
In 2015, researchers at the University of Chicago sought out violence prevention programs to fund and then measure how well they worked. This past fall, they published their findings. Teenagers who took part in the program were nearly 40% less likely to be arrested for a violent crime compared to students who weren't in the program. That was true even 2 years after finishing the program. It's part of a growing body of evidence that this type of therapy, CBT, can be a powerful tool to reduce violent behavior. Jens Ludwig, director of the university's crime lab, says that's because most violent crime is emotional. In the game of poker, there's even a phrase for letting your emotions get the best of you, being on tilt.
I think of gun violence as basically being a problem of people being on tilt with guns. Once you conceive of the problem that way, it changes your thinking about what you can do about it.
CBT rewires the brain, making it easier to avoid being on tilt and do things like walk away from a beef rather than retaliate. Some researchers caution that this kind of work takes a lot of resources to do well, and it's hard to replicate from place to place. But in Chicago, Choose to Change is expanding. Officials at Chicago Public Schools, which now funds the program with the city, estimate more than 4,000 students have taken part. The students in Englewood finished last fall, including AW, the student who felt angry so often.
I finally had somebody to talk to about it. And yeah, that's what made it better, because keeping all of it balled up, I was just treating people bad.
Last year, these students competed to design their own anti-violence program. They won third place nationally. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Search and rescue continues in Kentucky, where widespread flooding is responsible for at least 11 deaths. Communities are dealing with mudslides, power outages, and washed-out roads. Kentucky Public Radio's Justin Hicks reports that it's just one of several disasters to hit the state in recent years, and it's not over yet.
Gigi Neese, her husband, and their five dogs live in the small mountain town of Busy, Kentucky. They just finished building their house along with a dog grooming business in the basement. And on Saturday, Neese kept a close eye on the creek outside her home.
In about 30 minutes' time, I turned around and it was coming up on the steps. I kept hearing things banging into the basement. And it was terrifying.
That's when she knew it was time to abandon the house and all their possessions. They called 911 and were rescued in a boat. By the next morning, she says the roof of the house was an island in a muddy sea.
We lost our home.
our home completely submerged. We got out with our clothes, well, a few clothes that we was able to grab real quick while they rescued us.
They specifically built this house high off the ground to be flood resilient. That's because they lost their last one in a mudslide about 2 years ago.
We thought we were safe, and it still took the house again. So it's kind of hard to start rebuilding after 2 and 3 times.
For Kentuckians, each disaster is devastating, and they seem to be living through more of them. In 2021, historic tornadoes ripped through the plains of western Kentucky, killing 80 people. Then about 6 months later, historic flash floods swept through the mountains, killing 45. And now there's this. Here's Kentucky State Emergency Director Eric Gibson.
And this one is finding its way into that same kind of list. It is a major issue. We've seen serious damages across the state.
This event is unique because every single county in Kentucky is dealing with some flooding.
We had all the rain, then right in the middle of it, we had a tornado warning, so it's crazy, crazy weather.
That's Ricky King, emergency director in Muhlenberg County. He said they got about 7 inches of rain on Saturday, followed by 2 inches of snow the very next morning. Many of the deaths were in cars from people driving into high water.
They've had several wrecks this morning, some runoffs and some flood water. They had a guy earlier this morning that was submerged chest high in a pickup truck.
But there is a silver lining. Compared to the previous disasters, the state was better prepared, and so were rescue teams, says Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear.
One of the differences between this flood and July of 2022 is we knew this was coming.
He says there were more than 1,000 water rescues conducted in just 24 hours across the state. In the Appalachian City of Hazard, Bailey Richards says even people were ready this time. She helps promote downtown businesses.
As soon as it started happening, I was like, okay, well, I know what I got to do. We got to organize this and this. Because last time we were all just kind of staring there like shell-shocked, like, what do we do? And I think now we know.
Rivers are still cresting, and the full extent of the destruction likely won't be known for another few days when waters have a chance to recede. But then there's a snowstorm expected to hit the state Tuesday night. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks in Louisville. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The film industry had a difficult 2024, hobbled by strike delays, still recovering from the pandemic. But this year is expected to be Hollywood's big comeback. And to give us a sneak peek at the films it's coming back with, at least through Memorial Day, here's Bob Mondello.
Movie trailers feel awfully urgent this spring, pounding scores, earnest entreaties, huge stakes, almost as if Hollywood knows that to come roaring back, it needs to shock and awe.
When the need for certainty is absolute, and the odds are deemed impossible, the mission falls to him.
Should he choose to accept?
Oh, he accepts, even if it means hanging off a plane or riding a motorcycle off a cliff for real, because this is Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning.
You've always been on the right side, brother. I have no regrets. Neither should you.
Neither should anybody. It's been quite a ride for almost 3 decades now with Tom Cruise as IMF agent Ethan Hunt.
I need you to trust me. One last time.
You got it, Tom. And he's not the only former Brat Packer riding to Hollywood's rescue. With The Outsiders now a musical on Broadway, his long-ago castmate in that one, Ralph Macchio, is also returning to his roots.
You knew Mr. Miyagi?
I did not come looking for Sensei Miyagi.
Whoa, that's Jackie Chan.
I came looking for you.
And he's brought along a new protege. They're going to tag team train in Karate Kid Legends. Another legend, Robert De Niro, will star in a new mafia epic playing mob boss Vito Genovese.
Where do I start?
And also playing rival mob boss Frank Costello.
You're going down a very dangerous road. And we ain't been down dangerous roads before. But that's the risk you take. Me, I take
that. But you're not where I am. I give to charities, I pay my taxes.
De Niro meets De Niro in The Alto Knights.
Let's remember something. I put you where you are today.
And Michael B. Jordan has a similar double assignment in the thriller Sinners.
You twins?
Nah, we cousins.
Directed by Creed and Black Panther director Ryan Coogler, Sinners features Jordan as troubled twins Smoke and Stack.
We've been gone a long time. We're back now.
If double casting seems tricky, it's child's play next to what Oscar winner Bong Joon-ho does in his cloning epic, Mickey 17, where Robert Pattinson's title character gets killed again and again.
You're an expendable! You're here to be expended!
Every time I died, they just printed me out again.
Until one day he met himself.
Multiple.
Is that a problem?
In the case of multiples, we exterminate every individual.
Oh, right. That's what makes him expendable. Also expendable, at least in the eyes of their handlers, Thunderbolts, Marvel's latest team of anti-heroes and minor superheroes.
Who are you?
I'm Bob.
Some of them very minor. Less super, but plenty lethal, is Rami Malek as a CIA tech guy who everyone underestimates in The Amateur.
I don't think you could beat a 90-year-old nun in an arm wrestling match.
Do you ever account for the things I'm good at?
That would be a no.
We got a ping in Rome.
He's in London.
He just got on a bus in Prague.
He practically invented half of our surveillance.
Maybe y'all misjudge this individual.
And speaking of misjudging, Michael Fassbender gets totally blindsided in Black Bag, a Steven Soderbergh spy thriller, when he's tasked with plugging an information leak.
How long do you think you'll need?
Give me 2 weeks.
Thousands of innocent people will die.
Okay, 1 week. Who's the suspect?
Your wife.
That would be Kate Blanchett, who's also a spy.
I can feel when you're watching me.
Sorry.
I like it.
Life or death situations not what you're looking for in your leisure time? There are sweeter stories, too, quite a few about animals. In The Friend, Naomi Watts inherits her mentor's Great Dane when he dies.
You okay, bud?
I could feel him missing Walter in the same way I did.
The Legend of Ochi is about a town terrified by a fearsome mythical critter.
You're not like they say.
That doesn't seem all that fearsome to one little girl.
Harry, what is this?
I'm taking him home.
And an English teacher in Argentina saves the life of, and to his great annoyance is then adopted by, a more down-to-earth critter that ends up helping him with his students.
Why do you have a penguin on your desk?
To get you all to pay attention. If you keep this between ourselves, then I'll let you all feed him some fish at lunchtime. Deal?
The Penguin Lessons is based on a true story. If animals don't appeal, there's always sports to provide inspiration, say for a determined woman underdog in Uppercut.
Just give me one chance, okay?
So you want a box.
And I want you to train me.
Or a woman who makes professional wrestling her calling in Queen of the Ring.
I'm actually the highest paid female athlete.
In Washington?
in history.
Ephus is about aging baseballers and their tricks.
The Ephus pitch is a type of curveball so unnaturally slow that it confuses the batter, makes him lose track of time.
And then there's an athlete story that's less inspiring, Magazine Dreams, about a bodybuilder hopped up on steroids and obsessed with making the cover of a fitness magazine.
Like my deltoids? Judges always say they're too small. Ain't they liars?
Everyone's a liar.
Jonathan Majors was expected to earn Oscar recognition for Magazine Dreams until an assault and harassment conviction derailed the film's opening. His performance remains mesmerizing. While we're talking performance, there's a film called The Performance about a 1930s tap dancer.
I've been polite and nice, you know. I've said yes, sir, and no, sir, and it's okay that you underpay me because I love to dance.
When he finally gets an invitation to perform, there's a catch. He'll be dancing for the Nazis.
Harold doesn't even look Jewish.
People like you are trying to get out of there, dude. Any of you reading newspapers?
Sorry, things have gotten dark again. There are also some straight-up comedies, including a Lily Gladstone Bowen Yang remake of The Wedding Banquet about two couples, one gay, one lesbian, who stage a fake wedding.
Ned's grandmother flew in from Korea to meet her future granddaughter-in-law.
What are we supposed to do exactly?
We gotta dequeer the house. God, you have so much lesbian literature.
A wedding also figures in Ex-Husbands, about three generations in a family of inept spouses.
We're getting a divorce, your mother and I.
Is there someone else?
Not at the moment, but say I got 30 good years left in me.
30?
20, 25.
You'll be 110.
Also playing the elder card, the assassin comedy Old Guy makes an aging hitman work with a Gen Z hit dude.
You can do as I say.
Sure thing, Obi-Wan.
While in Riff Raff, former criminal Bill Murray gets drawn back into domestic squabbles at a family gathering.
There was this food incident, Rocco. If it's okay, I would just really like to torture him a little bit, if it's okay.
You shouldn't have done that, Rocco. Yeah, knock yourself out.
Oh my God, are we all gonna die?
Even in family films, that question comes up occasionally, say from the animated characters who must fight off a zombie attack in Night of the Zoopocalypse.
Did you just punch my grandma in the face?
Sorry, kid, but your grandma's a monster.
There's also a Looney Tunes movie, The Day the Earth Blew Up.
There's only one person that can do the job, Daffy Duck.
The Duck?
That's right, the duck.
You gotta be kidding me. Who greenlit this garbage?
Some popular digital world building comes to the big screen.
A wonderland where anything you can imagine is possible.
As long as what you imagine can be built out of blocks.
A Minecraft movie. And a story we all know from an animated classic returns as live action.
Magic mirror on the wall.
Who's the fairest one of all?
The queen is evil. You must flee into the woods.
And what will Snow White find in the woods? Dwarfs. Seven of them.
Wait. It's a human.
What did you think I was?
Nothing. Ghost.
Hi-ho, hi-ho. It's off to films we go. I'm Bob Mundell.
Hoping somehow, some way, there comes a miracle to find me. I close my eyes and see the girl I'm meant to be.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to...
Thank you.